Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Last week, we had a chance to visit with a man whose uncommon intelligence and leadership on matters involving our national security and other vital interests is exceptionally appreciated. Representative Paul Gosar of the 4th District of Arizona. Lo and behold, I ran into him this weekend at the Western Conservative Summit, which we were both addressing in Denver, Colorado, a terrific meeting. And we visited and realized that we might have a chance for a further chat, and I seized upon it. So, Congressman Gosar, it's so good to have you with us. Much to talk about, not least the Western Conservative Summit. Welcome back.
Oh, thanks, Frank. Oh, it was a fabulous time. And you were a participant as well, Frank, and the crowd welcomed your thoughts and comments. So it was a fun event and eye-opening.
Well, and you were participating in a particularly interesting panel involving one of the congressional representatives from Colorado, Ken Buck, and also Jody Heiss of Georgia. You were talking basically as three prominent members of the Freedom Caucus in the House of Representatives. And talk a little bit about your comments and those of your colleagues about how things are going in Washington at the moment.
I think a lot of people now have focused on the Freedom Caucus as why this group of men has gotten together, what they stand for, and what truly is behind their motives. And I think people got to see a glimpse of some of the talents. We're an accumulation of people that have special talents, and we utilize those. We debate them. But we also look at how we can best further the Constitution and how do we reform the processes that are going awry in Washington, D.C. So Ken was, you know, exquisite in his conversations in regards to judiciary. Jody has been a mix of our liberties and freedoms of speech. And then I also come from oversight where we're trying to hold government accountable. They tend to be the problem. Actually, they are the problem. And then what we can go doing forward, like reforms with public lands and stuff. So I think it was a wonderful forum. People got a glimpse as to, you know, these people aren't in it for themselves. They're in it for this country. And it also shows the point of where we've reached that we all have to be part of the solution. No one is exempt.
As you mentioned, Congressman Paul Gosar, you are a member of the Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, serving on its National Security, Homeland Defense, and Foreign Operations Subcommittee, among others. You're also a member of the Committee on Natural Resources, and you had a comment in the course of your remarks yesterday that I wanted to spend some time with you talking about today, about something called rare earth minerals. Tell us what those are and why we ought to be very concerned about the supply of these vital elements for national security as well as, more broadly, our economic interests.
Rare earths are a special group of minerals that have some special characteristics. You're seeing a lot of them if you have a cell phone, whether it's the crystals, whether it's the small micro filaments that are in there. They all come from these rare earths. And the future in communications and our national security and hardening of different materials for our military all come from these special aspects called rare earths. And what's happening right now is that now we have seen a foreign investor, namely China, that actually controls almost 100% of the marketplace. They dictate who gets them. And what they've done is they've been able to put out of business numerous times companies here in the United States who have been trying to mine them. What they do is they've slowly raised the rates until it becomes feasible for a company to invest in the United States. They flood the market, taking their legs out from underneath them. So it's financial economic warfare that they're participating in. The danger here, Frank, is that if you are solely dependent on an adversary like China for the rare earths that are so dependent for our national security and nuances in technology, what happens when they economically withhold them? We're at limbo, and we're blessed with a lot of these minerals, or we have some of the greatest concentrations of gold, silver, copper. We do have some rare earths. They're not as concentrated as China, but we do have them. And this has to be something that we look at in national security application.
As you were talking, Congressman Paul Gosar, about the importance of not having a dependency for these kinds of assets for national security considerations, not least, I was thinking about the Trump administration is now thinking about trying to respond to similar kinds of activities by the Chinese, really, as you say, economic warfare with respect to steel, making the argument that, you know, you can't have a military power worth a damn if you don't have a reliable supply of steel. But what you're talking about, another kind of critical asset for the military, among most other applications for that matter. And yet we have gotten ourselves in a position where they've essentially got a monopolistic control of the market. Congressman, as a member of this committee that is overseeing these natural resources, and specifically the Subcommittee on Energy and Mineral Resources, what are our options in this country? How do we get out from under this? How do we create a market for our own entities, our own companies, our own mines to produce what we clearly are going to need and not have them subject to this kind of economic warfare by the Chinese?
Our biggest problem is we're our own worst enemies. And the fact that we have this rich vein of minerals. I just recently visited up in upstate Minnesota, where the Boundary Waters are, and below it is where most of our steel came from World War I till today. But what ends up happening, we're seeing a presidential executive proclamation where we're withdrawing large swaths of this land just arbitrarily and putting it off limits. Not just the previous president, but previous presidents. Looking at the whims of the environmental community. And you know, all of us want clean air and clean water. But we also have to have the ability to promulgate our society and keep a prominence as the world superpower. But when you take these off site, there's no aspects of being able to get into that mining area. For an example, I went to the Twin Metals Mine up in the upstate Minnesota. Most people don't understand this is where most of our steel came from. Well, this was actually commissioned by Congress, separate from the Boundary Waters, for its exploitation of minerals. Most people don't realize that the clean water that Minnesota talks about is actually created by the mining communities. Our biggest problem is we've taken off most of this aspect from withdrawals or by permitting and EPA regulations that weren't intended by Congress and been misinterpreted. You saw the waters of the U.S., we saw the clean power rule, the ozone aspects.
Congressman, we're just about out of time, but I did want to mention one other piece. I had the opportunity years ago now to testify against a transaction that would have involved the sale of one of the most important of our mines, particularly for rare earth minerals, a Molycorp mine out in Mountain Home, California, as part of a sale of Unocal to communist China. And it almost went through. The so-called Committee on Foreign Investment of the United States, better known as CFIUS of the U.S. government, wasn't going to raise any objections to this transaction. It was crazy. Could you just say a word about this process led by the Treasury Department?
The Treasury is not the entity that should have anything to do with the treasures that we have in mineral wealth. They're superficial in their evaluation. We need to have people that have military experience as well as governances from like governors and states along with federal entities that actually understand the ramifications of dependency on these foreign minerals. We've seen a horrible issue of our problem emulating. Once upon a time, in 1990, we were probably one of the bigger producers of minerals. Now we're dwarfed by what China has done in this aspect. One of the only areas that actually has a new mineral up in Montana was actually bought by a company out of South Africa who is parented to China. And we don't have to look anywhere further, Frank, than when you look at Uranium One, where we have our uranium, 20% of our uranium being sold to the Russians by the administration previous with Clinton. So this is paramount that there's a national security, and we see this going on before our eyes. They invest, they buy, and they send it overseas.
Yeah, we need desperately to have people like yourself, Congressman Paul Gosar, holding accountable those in the executive branch and more generally our industries as well for the decisions that they're making almost entirely without attention to the national security implications of them. We look forward to working with you on that and much, much more. Congressman Paul Gosar, thank you again for joining us here at the Western Conservative Summit, but also for the great leadership you exhibit in Washington, D.C. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's so good to have with us, as we are privileged to have each week, a visit with Gordon Chang. He is our duty expert on matters involving Asia and that of many others, including The Daily Beast, where he has a column, also Forbes.com and WorldAffairsJournal.com, where he contributes regularly. He is the author of two very important books, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and The Coming Collapse of China. He is always a welcome guest here. And Gordon, thank you very much for taking a few minutes to join us.
Oh, Frank, as always, thank you very much.
We have a lot to talk about, Gordon. You have been reporting on this seemingly dysfunctional conversation between the United States and China that took place at the highest levels in Washington last week. You described it in a column at Forbes about the United States not trying to put any lipstick on the pig. Talk about what came of it and what comes next.
On Wednesday, the U.S. and China held high-level talks called the Comprehensive Economic Dialogue. This was supposed to be the capstone of President Trump's 100-day plan on trade that was announced at the end of the Mar-a-Lago meeting. It was specifically the plan of Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, and Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, but it came from the very top, from Trump and from Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler. The talks on Wednesday did not go well. We know that because the Treasury Secretary, only a half hour into the talks on the one-day dialogue, canceled the post-dialogue press conference. The Chinese did the same. Instead of issuing a joint statement, the United States issued a statement on its own. It's a real indication we're no longer lipsticking the pig. But also, I think it's a real change of attitude on the part of the administration, where they're no longer just going to accept vague promises from the Chinese and call it progress. This, I think, is an important change in the United States. I'm sure the Chinese are going to sit back and think about what happened in Washington. They'll probably offer some concessions. I hope the administration continues its resolute position on trade.
Our guest is Gordon Chang. You can find his works at, among other places, Fox News, but also Forbes.com, Daily Beast, and WorldAffairsJournal.com. Gordon, you were describing a very tense conversation between the United States and China, directed from the highest levels of the United States government, the president and his senior subordinates. Is there a trade war in the offing, as you see it, between the United States and China. Is that the next likely step?
Well, there has been a trade war that's going on. The Chinese have been waging it for a very long time, and the United States pretends it doesn't exist. So, for instance, China is becoming increasingly predatory, closing its market, especially with Xi Jinping's Made in China 2025 initiative, which seeks to have Chinese dominate 10 critical sectors, including computer chips and aircraft. And so we have to understand the nature of this challenge. The United States has been afraid to retaliate to protect American workers and businesses. And so, you know, we always talk about a trade war, something as we worry about in the future. We have been bleeding for a very long time. And so I think we have to acknowledge that a trade war has been in place. We need to start fighting it. This is not going to help the United States in one sense. You know, it will hurt us, but we are so far past the point where there are any no-cost solutions. We got to understand that through very bad policies, not only the previous administration, but the one before that as well, that we have put ourselves in a position where American workers have really been hurt. We need to do something, even if it costs us in the future.
Now, you have described in another piece at Forbes.com, Gordon Chang, that one of the things may well be the closing of the American market to the Chinese in order to essentially extract from them an opening of their market to us. Talk about how that might actually play out.
Our policies over the course of this century have been to try to open the Chinese market for American investment, for American goods and services. And we're trying to do that, of course, to help our businesses. But it really hasn't worked as a long-term strategy. I think the way that we're going to catch the China's attention is if we close our market to them, give them a real incentive to try to help us. You know, up to now, we've been trying to say, oh, you know, opening up your market, China, is going to be in your long-term interest. Well, of course it is, but that's not the way the Chinese see it. We have to recognize the Chinese view their interests in a very different way. So what we got to do is just close our market to them. That doesn't mean that we need to close our market to the rest of the world. On the contrary, we shouldn't. But we need to close our market to the Chinese to give them an incentive to deal with us fairly. Look, I'm not saying positively this approach will work, but I'm saying everything else has failed, so we should not try failed approaches again, because that makes us look wrong.
I can only imagine the howling that would be coming out of the Walmarts and the other chain stores and the like that are supplying American consumers immense amounts of these Chinese-made goods. But it does seem to me, Gordon, if you really are serious about ensuring that there's equal treatment for American companies in China, you've got to take a much more aggressive stance than we have to date.
And Frank, just one more point. We can buy our shoes and our toys from our friends. That would be, I think, important. Instead, what we're doing is we're buying them from a country which is using the proceeds from our sales to increase its military power, and they're directing that military capability against the United States. So from, you know, another perspective, a national security one, let's buy our shoes and stuff from Guatemala, Mexico, Vietnam, India, wherever. At least we will be helping our friends and not helping a country that means us harm.
I did want to ask you, though, about an issue that we've talked about in the past, and I just discussed with Congressman Paul Gosar, that could be another line of attack for the Chinese in this struggle, and that is using essentially the monopoly that they now have on rare earth minerals to, extort us into continuing arrangements that are, as you say, very dangerous to us. Talk us through that particular problem, Gordon, if you would.
Yeah. You know, in general, economists and others have not worried about China's hold on rare earths, largely because they figure, well, if the Chinese actually try to use that as a club, you know, rare earth production will start up in other places. And that's true. But I think the congressman has a real point when, you know, we look at the timing issue. Because if, for instance, something could go tragically wrong in North Asia, you know, we could be at a point where, you know, China does exercise its monopoly, and we're not able to, and we don't have the luxury of time to be able to restart production in California or wherever. And so the issue here is timing. And that's why I think that a lot of the traditional analysis is wrong. We've got to think of what happens if tomorrow there's a problem. The motto of U.S. Forces Korea is fight tonight. And that's indeed a reminder that in just a few hours, American forces can be engaged in history's next great war. If that's indeed the case, we cannot rely on anything coming out of China to help us.
Indeed. And as you and the congressman have both observed, this requires some lead time. So we better get about getting ourselves alternative supplies of rare earth minerals, preferably domestically, as quickly as we possibly can. Gordon, thank you so much. I had wanted to get an update from you on that problem in Northeast Asia, especially what you've written about at World Affairs Journal, the president beginning to squeeze Beijing, quite apart from this trade business, in connection with this trade business, on extracting from it, at long last, actual support for our efforts to constrain this growing danger from North Korea, but that will be for next week. In the meantime, my friend, thank you so much for your efforts and your good work and your joining us today. I look forward to our next conversation. In the meantime, stay well. Andy McCarthy joins us next. We'll be talking about investigations of the Trump team, testimony, collusion, pardons, and more. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Few things are more impressive than a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier. The occasion of the commissioning of a new one happens infrequently, and when it does, the event should be seen as a cause for national jubilation, as it marks a significant improvement in our country's ability to project power and thereby promote peace through strength. And so it was on Saturday when President Trump presided over the induction into the fleet of the USS Gerald Ford. The high point for me was when ordered to bring the ship to life, the Ford's crew raced aboard, fanning out along the deck in a dazzling display of discipline and patriotic pride. God bless the Gerald Ford and those who will, having brought her to life, now bring her to bear to protect the lives and freedoms of their countrymen. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is with the greatest of pleasure that I'm able to welcome once again to our microphones the fantastic Andy McCarthy. I use that term advisedly. I consider him to be a national treasure as well as a good friend. He is a former federal prosecutor turned extraordinary analyst and pundit, columnist, author, star of stage and screen, in other words, commenting on some of the most important, complex, and often vitally challenging topics of our time. And with all of that, I am very pleased to have him back to discuss some of them with us here at Secure Freedom Radio. Andy McCarthy, you're in the house virtually. God bless you. Let's talk.
Frank, great to be in the house, and thanks so much for the kind words.
Let me ask you about investigations. You have been doing an enormous amount of analysis of this at National Review Online and Fox News and PJ Media and elsewhere, Andy. The immediate topic, I guess, is the question of what, if anything, is coming of these investigations of so-called collusion between the Donald Trump campaign, transition, what have you, and the Russians. Give us a sit rep, if you would.
Well, this is the difficulty, Frank. The Justice Department, when they appointed Robert Mueller to be the special counsel, really did it outside the regulations that the Justice Department is supposed to follow with those kinds of appointments. Specifically, they're supposed to specify violations of law, the penal law, that are the predicate for having the special counsel in the first place. In this case, that was not done. Mueller essentially has carte blanche. He's really got boundless authority, and it's hard to nail down exactly what he is investigating, because the only thing the Justice Department did say is that he could investigate the probe that was described in the March 20th House Intelligence Committee testimony of former FBI Director James Comey. What Comey described in that testimony was a counterintelligence investigation, which, not to get too deep into the weeds, is not a criminal investigation. A counterintelligence probe is basically an information gathering exercise, which is intended to divine the intentions of foreign powers to the extent that they have ramifications for American national interests and to try to thwart the foreign powers. The intention is not to build a criminal investigation. So by not specifying any crimes and saying that Mueller was able to take over a counterintelligence investigation, there are no real boundaries that I can detect on Mueller's investigation.
Yeah. Andy, the president is rather exercised about that. In fact, he took to his Twitter account recently to inveigh against Jeff Sessions for getting him into this fix. You've written that actually he's got nobody to blame but himself for that fix. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, and about Jeff Sessions as the Attorney General of the United States.
Well, I think Sessions made a mistake in the timing and the sweep of his recusal. You know, the recusal regulations, Frank, are just like the appointment of a special counsel regulations. They require a crime so that everybody knows what, you know, they're recusing themselves from. And in this case, again, the investigation was a counterintelligence investigation. It's not about a crime. So at the time that Sessions recused, there really wasn't anything formal to recuse himself from. So I thought it was premature. It didn't mean he would never have anything to recuse himself for. He was a prominent part of the campaign. And to the extent an investigation would look at the campaign and the campaign's connections to Russia, if there were any, you could see him staying out of that. But there wasn't at that point, to my mind, anything that the regulations that he cited required him to step aside from. That said, the reason we got a special counsel, the president conveniently forgets, is because of the way he, meaning the president, handled the termination of FBI Director Comey. So the president started out by deciding to fire Comey, but telling the Justice Department he wanted them to do a memo to explain why Comey should be fired. Then when Comey was fired, Trump, instead of saying it was his decision, basically sloughed it off on the Justice Department and said he was merely following their recommendation that he had asked them for in the first place. And when that didn't fly, he then pivoted and said, well, it didn't have anything to do with the Justice Department. It was my decision, which, of course, pulled the rug out from under all of his administration spokesmen who had been going with the other story about how it was the Justice Department memo. And then in the middle of all this, right after firing Comey, the next day, Trump, astoundingly to me, hosted Russian diplomats at the White House. And during that meeting, not only berated Comey, but said that Comey's firing took pressure off him that he was feeling because of Russia, which, you know, if Trump had set out to help the Democrats with their Russian collusion narrative, and that had been his purpose, it's hard to imagine how he could have done a better job. So I think what happened was the deputy attorney general, who obviously didn't appreciate the criticism he got from Democrats and didn't appreciate the president basically making him kind of the fall guy in Comey's dismissal, decided to make amends and rehabilitate his Sterling Washington reputation by appointing Mueller and giving him free rein to take the investigation wherever he wanted. And that's basically how we ended up with this kind of wide scope jurisdiction special counsel investigation that the administration now faces. So that's why I say, you know, he really bears a lot of the blame for why this happened.
That's a very comprehensive enumeration of how we got here, Andy, and I appreciate very much both the dots that you've identified and connecting them in this way. Let me ask you about Sessions. The implication of the president's tweet was that he had found him to be an inferior candidate as attorney general to others he would have picked had he known that he was going to recuse himself. They somewhat walked that back subsequently. Just as a man who's spent a fair amount of time in and around the Justice Department, Give us an evaluation of the performance to date of Jeff Sessions, apart from this question of whether he prematurely or excessively recused himself.
Well, I think Sessions is an outstanding patriot, lawyer. Of the things I like about the Trump administration, he's at the top of the list. The fact that I don't agree with the timing and scope of his recusal is kind of beside the point as far as all that is concerned. I think to the extent that that the Trump agenda that people found attractive in the campaign, to the extent that that involves immigration and law enforcement, Sessions is a big part of that, and Sessions is a big part of why Trump got elected. So, yeah, I think it would be catastrophic for Trump in terms of keeping his support, keeping his conservative support, and keeping his base intact to let Sessions go.
To say nothing, Andy McCarthy, as you know better than most, of what it would take to get somebody else on the job. And if there is a problem with Rod Rosenstein, it's the prospect of him running the Justice Department doesn't suit, I think, most of us very well either.
Yeah, well, I thought, Frank, that it would be hard for Trump to replace Comey, and that actually seems to have gone fairly smoothly, although I guess the new FBI director is not in place yet. I expect he will be in place. But I think politically, in terms of his agenda, whether he was able easily to replace Sessions or not, it would be a catastrophe in terms of Trump keeping his coalition together to boot Sessions.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I hope it won't come to that. It seems as though that's not in prospect at the moment, but who knows with this administration at the moment. We'll stay tuned, and you'll be covering this for us magnificently, I know, at PJ Media and elsewhere. Andy McCarthy is our guest. He's graciously agreed to give us another segment. We're going to talk in the next one about some other investigations that are underway. You may have lost track of these, but we will discuss what's going on the Hill, including testimony from some of the players in the now highly controversial meeting between Trump campaign personnel and the Russians. That and more of the great Andy McCarthy right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're talking with Andy McCarthy, the former federal prosecutor who has continued his public service in the most extraordinary way. He is a contributing editor of National Review, where he writes a column several times a week, happily. He is a senior fellow at the National Review Institute. He also is a columnist for PJ Media and the author of more best-selling books than you can shake a stick at, including my personal favorite, The Grand Jihad. Andy, before we turn to a little jihad, let me ask you quickly about testimony this week from some of the president's relatives who had participated in a controversial meeting with the Russians last summer. In addition to all that we discussed in the previous segment about the investigation in the executive, talk about what's happening on Capitol Hill at the moment and what you expect to come out of this set of conversations with Donald Trump Jr. and Jared Kushner.
Well, Frank, I think this event that they are mainly being called to testify about, which was a recently revealed June 9th, 2016 Trump Tower confab between top Trump campaign officials and what certainly appears to be an emissary of the Putin regime is really a terrible development for Trump defenders, in that I think collusion being a very vague allegation, they've had a two-part response to it. The first part is that there's no evidence that there was any collusion, that is meaningful collaboration between the Trump camp and the Putin regime. Part two has been that even if there was collusion, collusion in what? Because simply because there's concerted activity doesn't mean that there's crime or anything terrible about it. So since it's a two-part response, I think it's a pretty big deal when one part gets eviscerated. And I think after the Trump Tower meeting that we've heard about between on the Trump side, Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, Paul Manafort, who was then the campaign chairman, and on the Russian side, a woman named Natalia Veselnitskaya, who was clearly a Kremlin-connected lawyer and who was coming on behalf of oligarchs who have connections to both Putin and Trump, and who supposedly was bringing along information that was damaging toward Hillary Clinton. And it was reflected in emails that the reason that was being done was part of the Russian government's support for Trump in the campaign. With all that, that makes it very, very difficult to credibly claim, and I don't think it's possible at this point to credibly claim, that there was no collusion at all. And we're really now down to what was the collusion about, what was the nature of it, what was the substance of it. So what I expect in this Capitol Hill testimony this week is that those two gentlemen, Donald Trump Jr. and Jared Kushner, are going to be pushed very hard on the fact that there was this meeting, why they would agree to take a meeting under those circumstances when it would give when it would give Putin leverage over Trump. All those things, I think, will be subject to pretty aggressive questioning.
Doubtless. Andy, you have opined that there doesn't seem to be a crime involved here. Certainly, charges that this is tantamount to treason seem overblown. And now there's talk from the president, no less, at least in sort of the abstract, of pardons. Do you anticipate that's how this is going to play out, is that we're going to see, in fact, charges raised that this rises to a criminal activity and that a pardon is going to be both necessary and forthcoming from the president?
It's not inconceivable that that could happen, Frank, but I think we're a long ways away from that. For the moment, I think this meeting is unsavory. I think that it's very possible that we don't have the final version on it. Trump Jr. changed his version of events three times in the space of a couple of days. But there is evidence that supports his latest version of events, that the meeting was about opposition research on Mrs. Clinton. It's not a crime to take opposition research. I think those people who say that it might be a campaign finance violation are really trivializing what happened here. And in any event, nobody's going to be prosecuted for that or removed from office over that. But, you know, you have to ask, since the channel was open and it's obvious that Russia was involved in the hacking of these Democratic email accounts, whether there was knowledge and participation in that on the part of anyone in the Trump administration. I think there's no evidence of that so far. And there's no reason sensibly why I think the Russian intelligence services would cut the Trump campaign in on what they were doing in that regard. I think they would just do it. But all that said, it's an investigation that has to be investigated. If there's nothing there beyond what we already know, I expect this will all come to nothing. If there's any evidence of purposeful collaboration in Russian hacking or something more serious in the way of collaboration between the Trump campaign and Russia to undermine the Democrats in the election, then I think you have a much more serious situation. But for the moment, I don't see that.
We've discussed in the past, and I don't want to get into it at length here, but it does seem to me as though, at least in the interest of a both fair and fulsome rendering of what is the history here of collusion with the Russians, that there are examples of actual collusion between senior officials and the Russians, interfering in our elections, interfering in our economic interest, interfering in our national security, that just happened to involve Democrats that also should be right. subjected to the same lens. Is that overreaching?
No, I don't think so, Frank. I don't think any of this should be considered in a vacuum. And let's not forget, let's go to the ultimate issue that nobody would prefer to talk about, which is impeachment, right? Impeachment is a political remedy, not a legal one. And even if they came up with something that convinced the House to vote articles of impeachment at some point against Trump, they would have to have a trial in the Senate where they would weigh whether this merited removing him or not. And in that instance, you would have to compare what happened here to other relationships with the Russians and other activities with the Russians that we as a political system have tolerated. And to my mind, intolerably so, for the last number of years. So I don't think any of this should be considered in a vacuum.
Very important point, Eddie. Lastly, and very quickly, what is your view of this voting fraud examination? The left is going nuts pillorying some of the people involved in it, many of whom are friends of ours and frequent guests on our program, for that matter. Tell us about what you think is the nature of the problem that they are trying to investigate, how they're doing it, and whether they should be allowed to continue to do so.
Well, Frank, I frankly find myself dizzy on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday reading about how the Democrats are concerned with the attacks on the integrity of our election system in connection with Russian collusion. And on the other days of the week, they say anyone who actually wants to do anything about the integrity of our election system in order to bolster it is actually shredding the Constitution. I really can't. I can't kind of keep up with where the Democrats are coming from on that. To my mind, the investigation that has been launched is an information gathering exercise about election integrity, specifically who's voting in our elections, because whenever somebody who's not qualified to vote in an election votes, that cancels out an American's ballot, which should be of concern to everyone. So I don't understand how the champions of Bob Mueller the rest of the week are complaining about people trying to gather relevant information.
Thank you, Eddie, for your time today, as always, and for the great work you do. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's a great pleasure to have with us, for the first time in an altogether too long time, my friend John Fonte. He is a senior fellow and the director of the Center for American Common Culture at the Hudson Institute. He's the author of numerous books, including, I believe, most prominent among them, Sovereignty or Submission: Will Americans Rule Themselves or Be Ruled by Others?, for which he won the Paluchi Baghout Book Award. He has contributed mightily through any number of other outlets, including National Review and American Greatness, and it's always a delight to have him with us to talk about his thinking on particularly the challenge that we face at the moment to our sovereignty and our national character. John Fonte, welcome back. It's so good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. It's good to be on your show.
So you did a piece that sort of encapsulated many of your most important observations about all this that I thought was very interestingly titled. You described it at American Greatness as Donald Trump versus the Post-West. What is the Post-West, and why is it posing such a threat to us?
We're used to hearing terms like postmodern, meaning after modern, or post-national, after the nation state. So we also have this phenomenon what I call the post-West, after the West. Well, for the last, say, 10 or 15 years, Western leaders, that would include American presidents, British prime ministers, German chancellors, are embarrassed by using the term Western civilization or talking about Western civilization in any form. We know that in the universities in what we call the West, Western civilization is trash, is oppressive, racist, imperialist, and so on. So I'm suggesting that part of the reluctance to even deal with this issue and part of the attack on President Trump's speech was both people who are anti-Western but also post-Western, as we've seen in the academy and in journalism and the Davos crowd and so on over the last 12 years. So that's why I use that term.
And they have more in common, it turns out, these elitists, than they do to people from their own countries like ours. And this is much in evidence at the moment, I think, John Fonte, in the efforts of the Brits to extract themselves from the clutches of one of the ultimate elitist operations, transnational operations, I think you've called it, namely the European Union. It sounds as though this is getting uglier. The mask, if you will, of the EU is beginning to slip vis-a-vis the Brits. Talk a little bit about that as a sort of case study of what these guys are about.
Yes, this is sort of the British Declaration of Independence. So the imperial power, in this case, the leadership of the European Union, of course, doesn't like it. If the Brits get away with this and they succeed, it may be a signal to others and lead to the dissolution of the European Union as a union. Doesn't mean you can't have a strong Europe of nation states, by the way, or through NATO. I mean, there's other ways of having a strong European partner for the United States besides through the European Union. The European Union, they're going to try to make it as difficult for the British as possible. So we'll see how these negotiations work. But this is, it's clearly the intent of the chief negotiators for the EU at this point to make it as difficult as possible to prevent trade deals and this sort of thing. The EU is post-sovereign, too. Let's use another post. Post-nation state. They don't believe in national, they're an enemy of national sovereignty. They've shown it in their treatment of Central Europe. In their treatment of the British.
Yeah, talk a little bit about the Central European situation, because that is a whole nother story.
Yes, there's what's called the Visegrad countries. That's Poland, Hungary, Slovakia, the Czech Republic, want to maintain their independence. These were countries that were under communism. They were ruled by Moscow. They don't want to be ruled by Brussels any more than they want to rule by Moscow. And a number of their leaders they want what I would call democratic sovereignty. Philadelphian sovereignty. I mean, it's where the people rule, not necessarily the state. And they've elected some conservative governments and governments that are interested in national sovereignty. The EU has come with a vengeance attempting to promote sanctions and this sort of thing. A quick example, Poland. Currently, the judges are appointed in Poland by a judicial commission. The judges pick themselves, like Ruth Bader Ginsburg picking her successors. The Polish government is moving to a system more like ours, where the elected democratic officials choose the judges, and they have to be confirmed by parliament, just like ours is confirmed by Congress. So the EU, of course, considers this an attack on democratic values. They have sort of a judicial system like the United States. That's one quick example. So they're attempting to basically dictate the terms of both democracy and cultural issues, social issues, to these nations. So the nations are fighting for sovereignty and independence. That's just one battle, and President Trump addressed this in his speech.
One aspect of this that's particularly worrying to me, John, is the effort of the EU to impose what amount to Sharia blasphemy codes with restrictions on free speech, where people might, however, inadvertently give offense to Muslims. These are really fundamental national sovereign decisions, and as you know better than most, so central to the idea of a real functioning democracy as well. So this kind of elitist operation is alarming. I know you've also been giving thought to more generally what is going on with respect to the practice of this sort of elitist enterprise at the expense of, or really under the rubric of, ironically, a global democratic movement, which many of us have espoused over the years. Talk a bit about that, if you would, John Fonte.
Yes, I think what's happened over the last, particularly over the last decade, in the beginning, was the idea of global democracy was part of the anti-communist fight. The organizations were formed, in fact, the U.S. government helped form them, and various think tanks like Freedom House were involved. And this was basically was anti-communist. It was working with freedom fighters and throughout the world and promoting global democracy as part of the struggle against communism. After the fall of communism, and over time, this what we could call now the global democracy establishment has moved pretty far, has moved to the left. And now it's simply a promotion of progressive policies. And of course, the key figure in this is George Soros, who worked very closely with the Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama State Department, places like Macedonia. They were basically attacking sovereignty, trying to bring them under EU control, but also going ahead on what we call social issues, definitions of marriage, Christianity, radical feminism, this sort of thing, promoting a left-wing position rather than just, you know, letting the people of these countries decide for themselves what kind of society they want to live in. So this is going on today. So it's important that President Trump, I think, reverse these policies once he gets a hold of the State Department and examine some of these levers, because they're no longer promoting global democracy. They're promoting global progressivism, or what I call transnational progressivism. It's a partisan position. They're now pushing the partisan left and not being an honest referee for democracy.
Amen. John, your leadership on that front is tremendously appreciated. Let me ask you about one other issue before we have to let you go very quickly. This idea of using the United States military as a vehicle to provide effectively amnesty for illegal aliens. What's up with that?
No, I think it's totally absurd. Essentially, what these people are saying is that soldiering is a job Americans won't do. It's a job Americans have done since before the Declaration of Independence, since the first shots were fired in 1775, even before that in colonial wars, again in the French and Indian War. So it's a job Americans have always done. This is an attempt. Another, it's an attempt by the pro-open borders amnesty crowd to attempt to come up with favorable illegal immigrants, you know, like Dreamers, or in this case, people who might volunteer for the army. There's plenty of Americans to do the job. This is a job that Americans can do. It's an insult to American citizens to suggest otherwise.
Well, and more to the point, in a way, it also may be a real peril to our men and women in uniform, and perhaps to the rest of us, if we wind up having people who have gotten into and are getting their access to citizenship, no less, as well as hardware that could be used to kill us. John, as is always the case, there's too little time to do justice to the many things that you've been working on so brilliantly at the Hudson Institute of late. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. Hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afton. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.